Good afternoon on an Independence Day weekend from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Bankey, and this is the July 3rd, 2010 edition of Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Well, I hope everyone is having a great weekend, enjoying a little midsummer break. I hope I am too, as well, we put together today's show earlier this week so Mrs. Bankey and I could get away for a weekend and relax. So as we move along on today, we're going to do a special Best of Space Talk edition and hear some highlights of previous interviews. Today we'll hear from Apollo 15 astronaut Al Warden, legendary shuttle flight director Wayne Hale, Apollo 12 moonwalker Alan Bean, and our own director of the Kennedy Space Center, Bob Cabana. But before we enjoy some of those clips from the past year, I do want to take a couple of moments here and comment about some news from the past week. The White House released its national space policy this week and got some folks spun up again based on what it did say and what it did not say. I was glad to see that space exploration was at least mentioned, with some words anyway, about putting humans on asteroids by the year 2025 and landing on Mars in the mid-2030s. Perhaps like you, for me, that's still too long to wait. A space policy document is basically just supposed to lay out the broad sweep of what we want to do and say who should do those things. So some folks who are looking for a lot of hype and sizzle and inspirational rhetoric basically came away disappointed from the document. But again, it is just a government document. It's a space policy. It's not supposed to set us on a challenging path to the future by using, you know, visionary eloquence and guaranteeing money to back it up. Our president is supposed to do that. And like you, we're still waiting for that visionary rhetoric, that visionary eloquence to tell us where we're going and why. You know, the other thing that's worth noting about the new policy that I think is important, it does spell out that we're going to continue to support commercial space activities at every turn. I can remember not too long ago the word commercial wasn't even in the national space policy, and to see it supported so strongly is something that's really good news. And of course, I absolutely support 100%. The development of a commercial space sector that goes well beyond today's launching of commercial communication satellites on commercial rockets. Another thing that I think was important that the space policy emphasized was an increased reliance and support of cooperating with our international partners in space. It's going to take an entire planet to do the kind of things we want to do in space now and certainly in the far future. And, of course, you know, it doesn't say whether or not we should include China in that, and that's been a topic of debate for the last couple of weeks. And I'm still not real sure, not personally convinced, really one way or the other, whether that's a good idea. And so I continue to look at that and continue to seek feedback and comment from other folks. Most interesting to me, though, out of the space policy was the fact that really for the first time I can remember or see in my experiences that there was a very strong wording about the importance of space assets, you know, our nation's satellites that provide communications, that provide our weather forecasting, that the GPS system that provide our navigation signal and timing signal that goes with the navigation. All of that is so important to and has become so important to the very fabric of our culture that in our national space policy, and this is really more from a military standpoint, that we've called out the fact that we're going to protect those assets and let other nations know not to mess with our stuff in space. Well, we're going to talk a lot more about our national space policy in the coming weeks, of course, as we continue to see what happens in Congress. But for now, let's go to the tape, as it were, and hear from Apollo 15 command module pilot Al Warden, who on July 11th of last year talked a little bit about our future plans in space. As we talk about going back to the moon, do you feel we need to go back to the moon? Or you know, some of your astronaut colleagues are saying, let's go directly to Mars. Can you talk about kind of where you think we've been and where we need to go?
Well, Jim, let me tell you, to begin with, I think it's imperative that we search out other places that, you know, in the distant future, we're going to need to go to survive. I think the imperative that all people have in their genetics somewhere is survival of the species. It's great that we can put a twist on it to go to the moon, but in my mind, the whole program is to put us in a position where someday when we can no longer live here, we can go somewhere else. And I think that's kind of a genetic drive in human people. Mm-hmm. We've been to the moon. We went there to show that we could do it. We went there to find out what the moon was all about. I think it's important that we go back, not to find more rocks. We don't need that. But what we need to do is to get ourselves prepared to go to Mars. And the way to do that is to live on the moon for a length of time that's going to equal the time that they'll be on Mars when they go there, and find out and make sure that, and find out what it's like, find out what we have to do, and make sure we can survive on a hostile planet for up to 6 months.
There's a lot of talk about using, obviously, the lunar resources right there, pulling hydrogen, oxygen, possibly water.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. In fact, as I understand it, they'll be looking at a landing site close to the south pole of the moon. Because there's some indication that there might be some water there. And I think if they find water, then they can do a lot of things with it, develop fuel, develop, portable supplies, help them subsist for the 6 months that they're going to be there.
So a lot of folks have said over the years, again, in terms of the meaning of Apollo, that and in fact, some have said that Apollo 8 was actually a bigger mission than even 11, in the sense, as you were talking about finding a new place to go, that for the first time in human history, humans had the ability to decide whether they wanted to stay or go, and they chose to go. Is that a kind of a, I guess, an observation or philosophy?
Well, let me take you back a few centuries. Why did Columbus come to the New World?
Right.
The history of mankind, the history of human beings, is that kind of history where they go out and they find new things where they can live, they can get away from whatever is bothering them at home. The people who landed at Plymouth Rock were getting away from a very repressive regime in England. Columbus came over to find riches. I mean, there are all kinds of reasons to find new places to go, and they're not all just because you love to go somewhere. They had specific reasons for going to these places,
mm-hmm.
And I think we're going to find over the next, maybe it'll be 100,000 years, I don't know. Not going to happen overnight, not going to happen quickly, but we're going to develop the capability, we're going to develop the propulsion systems that will take us where we want to go, and we're going to find a place where if the sun finally gets to the end of its life cycle, we'll be able to go somewhere else.
And we need to, and we've only got a few billion years to go, and people laugh at that, but that's not a lot of time. I mean, if you want to move the species to another galaxy, or at least another solar system, I should say,
well,
you got to get going.
If you want to put that down in terms that everybody understands, there was a time not too long ago when everybody thought that our oil reserves on the Earth were unlimited,
mm-hmm.
That they would never go away, and now we're finding that, hey, that is a limited resource. People think that the sun will last forever, but it's not going to last forever. And I think the nature of human beings is that we're going to do everything we can to survive that event, and that survival may mean we got to go somewhere else. So this is a very, very, very small step in the quest for the survival of the species. But I think over 100,000 or even a million years, I don't care if it takes a million years, mm-hmm. we're going to develop the capability to do that someday.
Al Warden's appearance, by the way, on Space Talk was facilitated by the Astronaut Scholarship Foundation, which he is chairman of the board of directors. And it's a great organization, and I strongly encourage anyone to support their efforts whenever you can. When we return, we'll have some great space shuttle stories and talk about our space program through the insights of former flight director Wayne Hale as this Best of Space Talk edition continues, brought to you by United Space Alliance. I'm Jim Banky, and you're listening to WMMB. Welcome back to our special July 3rd Best of Space Talk edition, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Coming up later in the program, we'll hear from Apollo 12 moonwalker Alan Bean, as well as former shuttle astronaut and current director of the Kennedy Space Center, Bob Cabana. But right now, let's take you back to September 19th, 2009, when our special guest was former shuttle flight director Wayne Hale, who today continues to work for NASA and has become quite well known in space circles for his insight, his stories, and his commentary, especially expressed through his online blog hosted on the NASA website. When he joined us, we spent some quality time talking about what it's like to manage a shuttle mission, what goes through the minds of a flight director having to make some critical decisions, and as well as how NASA's culture might have changed since the 2003 Columbia accident. That culture change perhaps led in many ways by Wayne himself. But let me introduce Wayne by saying this. Now, I have never met or gotten to know a flight director that I didn't have respect for. These are special people who are responsible for the safety and success of the mission. And I have to tell you, and I think a lot of my longtime friends in the media would agree, that when we heard that when Wayne Hale was on console, you could watch the activity in Mission Control with a greater sense of security, a greater sense of confidence that the right decisions would be made, that everything would be right with the world at the end of the day. I truly believe he is among NASA's best, a modern-day Christopher Kraft or Gene Kranz, and I'm proud to welcome him to our program today. Wayne, it's good to have you with us.
Well, it's good to be with you, Jim. What an introduction. What can I say after that?
Well, you certainly deserve it, sir. And let's talk for a few minutes about your experience as a flight director. Now, I know astronauts are always get the question, what's it like in space? And some of them cringe at that question, and some of them answer it quite nicely. Let's try it out for size with you. But let's ask you, what's it like to be a flight director? You're standing there, it's a few minutes before launch, or it's a few minutes before you have to make the go, no go for a deorbit burn to land a shuttle. What's that like to stand there and be responsible?
Well, it's a great feeling knowing you have a great team that you've been working together with for many months to prepare for those moments. Of course, there's a great deal of responsibility, and it weighs heavily on your mind, but we have practiced what we're doing. We have been through all the training, and after a few flights, the experience that's under your belt makes you feel confident that you can make the right decision and make sure that if it's safe to go, we'll execute, and if it's not, we'll wait till the next day. And either way, those are good decisions.
You ever feel yourself being one that either erred on the side of caution or erred on, or maybe took a little risk now and then? Or I mean, how do you measure that?
Well, I think I even wrote about it in my blog one time about how rookie flight directors can kill you.
That's
and
right.
Looking back on my very first entry, I did send the crew to a place or a situation that maybe wasn't quite the safest. So you learn from those experiences and go forward.
Now, I remember early on in my career as a journalist, one of the things that I didn't understand, I didn't get, was this whole concept of flight control, I guess philosophy. You know, why do you make the decisions that you make, and what guides you to make those decisions? When I learned that flight rules were really more guidelines than anything else, I had a problem with the hard Webster definitions of all these words. And I remember talking to you, I remember talking to Gene Kranz and others about that, and one of the themes that came out that struck me and remains with me today is this notion of keeping your options open. Is that really what guides everyone? At every point, you're trying to keep your options open so that you don't shut down one idea as you get to the next?
Well, you know, we are trying to accomplish a mission, so we have trained and planned for more than a year in advance for every shuttle mission. Everything we're going to do every day has been thought through, pitted against other options that we might do, and so we think we have the very best plan that we can put together, and we train that way. But when the day comes and you're faced with a specific situation, maybe something you'd thought of, maybe something nobody'd thought of, you really need to take as much time as is available to you to look at the options, look at the way forward, what is the best way to go. And you take the rules as a starting point, and in most cases, that's exactly what you're going to do. But in some cases, there will be some nuance or circumstance or particular thing that's going on that day that says maybe what the flight rule said is not the best way to proceed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the judgment, training, and experience all comes to play.
And certainly that's where we as laymen have to trust you to make the right call. And I know that, you know, you work out these procedures, but the simulations seem to me, just, and you just mentioned, so important. You know, that you've tried to goof it up as many different ways as you can and still recover what's going on. That's got to give you a lot of different options to consider every time you see something go wrong.
We have a wonderful training team, and they love their jobs because they sit around and they think about all the things that could go wrong. It's like playing a chess game to see how the flight control team's going to react. Sometimes we react the way they expect. Sometimes we surprise them, but we always learn in those training sessions, and they're invaluable.
Now, is a flight director position, Wayne, more of a management, I should say management, a leadership position? Is it, I mean, you've got to have the technical background, but do you need to be a hardcore engineer to work into that position? Do you need to be a good leader, a good communicator? What are the skill sets?
We absolutely have to have the technical background. It is a technical field. You have to understand the engineering. You have to understand the orbital mechanics. You have to understand the medicine sometimes that we have to talk about with the crew.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a leadership position. You are with a group of folks who have been assigned to the team. You've got to mold them into a team and prove that they can do the job that's ahead of you. We have to mentor some of the new flight controllers as they go through their training to bring them to a certified status and get them out on console. And every day that you are working in the flight director's office, you are exercising your job as a leader. It's a great job in many ways, and not the least of which is you get to avoid some of the bureaucracy that much of the other parts of NASA management have to put up with,
right.
Unfortunately found out.
And as you recently wrote in one of your blogs, always make sure that you inform senior management with every decision you're going to make.
Absolutely. There is a myth that the flight director is there by himself making the decision. And, you know, if it's absolutely time critical in the middle of launch or something like that, yes, that's true. But 99% of the time, you're talking about making a decision about how something will be done tomorrow or 6 hours from now. And you'd be foolish not to call in help and get other folks' perspective on how you should proceed.
Well, and let me ask you quick about the relationship between you as a flight director and the shuttle mission commander. I've heard it described at one point that the flight director is responsible for the success of the mission, and you share responsibility for the safety with the commander ultimately responsible for the safety. Is that a way to phrase it, or am I missing a nuance?
Well, you know, it's again, you're in a teamwork situation. The shuttle commander is on the scene. He's got information that you don't have as a flight director on the ground. The flight director on the ground has this huge team of people and all these resources and a lot of information the shuttle commander doesn't have at his fingertips. And so you've got to learn to work together. You've got to learn to trust each other. And through the years, I've had relationships with commanders that were just great, hand-in-glove kind of relationship,
mm-hmm.
And great camaraderie. And then we've had some prickly situations where you kind of had to bite your P's and Q's, and sometimes things didn't work as smoothly as you hoped they would.
And certainly that reflects the fact that we're all human and a little different, and so you're going to get a variety. Astronauts are not cookie-cutter people, let's put it that way.
They are not. You know, sometimes I think the public gets the impression that they're all alike, but no, they're human beings, and everyone's unique and an individual.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, let me ask you about culture, and we've got just a couple of minutes here before our next break, but following the Columbia disaster, Wayne, as you know, there was a lot of talk about the culture in NASA and how it needed to be changed to adopt a new way of looking at things. And you were right on the forefront of that. And in fact, I think you were very much known for embracing that concept and really did some unique things to try to change the culture. How do you assess where the culture is at today? And is it poised to move on to the future?
Well, you know, changing a culture in an organization is very difficult, and it takes a long time. But after about 6 years, I think we've made great inroads, and many things are much better than they were before Columbia. You know, it's almost a generational thing. The way in which our parents' generation reacted to leadership and authority is different than the way the younger generation today reacts to leadership and authority.
Mm-hmm.
And what came out of, you know, maybe the World War II kind of generation of just take orders doesn't work well today. So we have worked very hard to change that, and I think it has largely changed. There's still room for improvement, but the idea that we're going to suppress somebody's ideas or just tell them to shut up and get on the truck sort of a thing, those days are behind us, and I think for the better.
Our Best of Space Talk program, brought to you by United Space Alliance, continues with an Apollo Moonwalker after we observe this 5-minute built-in hold to catch up on the latest news, weather, and sports. So please stay tuned. I'm Jim Banky, and you're listening to WMMB.
Be here for the heroes in orange jumpsuits.
Be here to feed your curiosity.
Be here for the goosebumps.
Major goosebumps.
Be here for the eye-opening.
Jaw-dropping.
Excitement.
Of exploring space.
Be here for a day of fun.
And a lifetime of inspiration.
Be here at Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. From now until July 11th, stop by participating McDonald's restaurants for a coupon worth $5 off your admission to Kennedy Space Center.
Welcome back to the second half of Space Talk on WMMB, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Well, the 40th anniversary of Apollo 12 was marked last fall on Space Talk, with a visit from Apollo 12 moonwalker, Captain Alan Bean. Here he is from our program on October 24th, 2009.
Someday I will own original work of art by none other than Alan Bean, who joins us by phone from Houston. Welcome, Captain Bean. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing good, Jim. Good idea. I'll be anxiously awaiting your phone call, because I'd love to have you own one, someone that cares as much about space as you do.
Well, it's good to talk to you. It's been a few years, but we've been following you and watching you, and you seem to be doing very well for yourself.
Well, I'm working hard at trying to preserve one of the great adventures of humankind, which was the Apollo program, and I'm often asking myself, when Neil went to the moon and came back, was that bigger than Magellan going around the Earth? I don't know.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Boy,
what your listeners think?
Yeah, that's true. I think historically it ranks right up there. And I always get a kick out of people. And sometimes I wonder if not the Apollo 8 mission wasn't even more historically significant than the landing itself. You know, the idea that we were first leaving Earth orbit and we could decide whether to stay or go, and we chose to go.
Yeah, I think it was for insiders, but it appears to me, looking at what other people want to put in history books, I think the fact that Neil actually touched the moon seems more important to the layman than maybe it does to us. I don't know.
Well, and let's talk about Apollo 12 now, because, again, that often gets, you know, lost in the shadow of Apollo 11. I mean, we recall, you know, and again, you'd have to know some of your space trivia, of course. You certainly know this, having lived the flight, but we recall Apollo 12 in the space community as the one that got hit by lightning, as the one that landed close to the Surveyor spacecraft on the moon. Some even remembered as the one we didn't have the camera for. Sorry about that. But now, 40 years later, Captain Bean, what do you think? What do you think Apollo 12's place in history should be?
Well, I think probably we all should be supporting the primary goal of getting humans to the moon and back safely. Now, you know, the goal was just to get a team or even one to the moon and back, but really Apollo was designed to get a number there and back, which we actually accomplished.
Sure.
We didn't, and so I think just being part of that and part of this great adventure, difficult, impossible dream at the time when I came into the space program in 1963, it was an impossible dream. Yet in 1969, in July, when Neil Armstrong stepped on the moon, well, suddenly it became possible.
You know, my favorite episode, truthfully, sincerely, not just because you're on, is from the Tom Hanks series From the Earth to the Moon, is the Apollo 12 episode. I can watch that thing over and over again, and it was really neat because it was told more or less from your perspective. Tell me how much of that was reality and how much of that was fake.
I thought 100% was reality.
Really?
Yes, but what I do know as an artist, that to make things interesting, you've got to take reality and sort of amplify it a little bit.
Right.
You know, make it even more strong or even more beautiful or whatever you're trying to do. So I think what they did, they never told a single thing in that episode that wasn't true. But then when you got the emotion in it, they made the emotions a little bit more than maybe what we actually experienced. So all the facts were there. Everything was just right. We were great fans, had fun. But when they invented a situation, they didn't invent the situation, but when they made the situation in that movie, then
right.
they, you know, made it a little more exciting than maybe it was or something like that. That's show business, though.
Right. Well, and of course, you all are test pilots, and you have a very methodical way of thinking and a very logical way, and you sort of do take the emotion out because you want to report the facts, you want to report the numbers and the data. You don't want to sit there and revel in the wonder and poetry and imagination of it all.
Well, you're absolutely right, and that's kind of part of the training you get. And I think that it's one of the problems I think we've had convincing the public of the wonder of spaceflight, because people get up there and say, which isn't true, even close to true, oh, well, it's not any more dangerous than driving to the supermarket. Well, that's crazy. That's a crazy thought. But people say that because they want to be cool. They want to be brave or something. And we do know just by looking at the accident rate of the shuttle, it's not exactly like driving to the supermarket. We've lost a shuttle every 57 flights. I
yeah.
hate to think that every 57 flights to the supermarket, I'm getting ready to get killed. So,
yeah.
No, it's but that's just the tradition and the culture of piloting as opposed to the movies. Now, the movies, they would say it's going to happen every 25 times. See, that's how they exaggerate.
Well, and yet what's so fascinating about you, sir, is that, you know what, you do have the ability to see both sides. And in your paintings and what you did, what you're doing with your artwork, you know, really shows that you've been able to take those feelings and those emotions and literally add color to what is an otherwise gray landscape with your moon stuff.
Yes, and it hasn't been easy. I often say, you know, I couldn't do these paintings because I can't go back to the moon and pose somebody that way, so I've got to use models and have just the right lighting and this and that and the other, and then I say, I need the engineering to do that. But then I say, if I want to show what you said, the emotion, picking out the events that are more interesting, then I've sort of got to get away from the engineering aspect or the astronaut aspect, the calm, cool astronaut, and kind of say, what was the most exciting thing? What was the most interesting thing that I think the audience would want to remember about any of the Apollo missions? So it's both sides. It's both sides of the brain to do it, to be an artist.
Yeah, and that's something. And you've been able to combine them. You still have enough spacesuit material where you're putting that into your canvases?
Yes, I do. But I'm telling you, I like the flag that they gave me from my suit. Now the part that's to the right of, let's say, to the right of the stars is all gone and in paintings. All I've got is the blue stars, that field, and then the red stripe, red and white stripes underneath it. So I'm using it up, but at the same time, I'm 77. So I hope to be around for a while, but I won't be around forever. And it'd be nice if they ran out the same day. We'll say this. Building the space station, repairing the Hubble Space Telescope, those are impossible dreams too. So it's not like we quit doing impossible things at NASA at the end of Apollo program. No, that was just one that history will remember real well. But I think people at NASA, they're at the Cape and at Houston and JPL and these other things, they are doing impossible dreams achieving impossible dreams or working towards it every single day. It's an amazing accomplishment by human beings every day.
Well, and the Augustine panel comes out this week with some of their recommendations or some other studies underway. We may not hear exactly what direction the White House wants to take until the budget comes out early next year. But all that said, with all the hand-wringing going on, do you think this is all good? Is this necessary? Are we heading in the right direction?
I think we're headed in the right direction. We're not going as fast as I would like. But that's why we have elections every 4 years and 2 years in some cases, to let the American people decide what they want their leadership to do, or pick the leaders that are going to decide these things. So we're anxious that the president will say, I've decided to move ahead to keep America at the forefront of space exploration. We know you're going to need three or four more billions of dollars a year, maybe run it up to 22 or 23 or something, and he decides to do it. But at the same time, if he doesn't, people elect him president for a reason.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that he wants to do this, but he doesn't phone me and tell me, so I wish he would, so I could tell you.
Well, your work certainly inspires a lot to pursue that, and let's talk about your work one last minute here. As I recall in talking to you years ago, we had talked about whether or not you would ever start doing kind of fictional stuff, flights of fancy, the way it might look someday, and you at that time were sticking to what you knew, historical stuff, historically accurate stuff. Is that still where you're headed? Are you ready to start dreaming and doing futuristic stuff, or are you still into the historically accurate?
I'm into historically accurate with the exception if there's something that I wish we did. For example, I did a painting. We all know that Al Shepard hit the golf ball on the moon.
Right.
Great. And I asked Pete Conrad, why didn't we think of something like that? And he says, well, we don't play golf. I said, well, what could we have done? He said, well, we like to watch football. We could have taken a football and thrown it around and shown it on TV. If I hadn't broken the TV, he
yeah,
said
right.
that. He said that. And I did a painting called Are You Ready for Some Football?
Oh.
But I show in the painting that really we didn't do that, but we wish we'd thought about it. But I know that other present-day astronauts, when they go back to the moon, will look at that painting and they'll say, let's take a soccer ball.
Yeah.
Let's take a basketball. Let's take a football.
That's right. And if one team were named the Vikings and the other team was named the Steelers, the Vikings would beat the Steelers by at least 7 points. But that's another.
Maybe they would. Maybe they would. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you this. If we had done that, which we didn't even think of till after we got home, if we'd done that, they'd show that footage at halftime in the Super Bowl.
Oh,
because
absolutely.
Someday the NFL will play in big domes on the moon.
Well, it was a great interview and a lot of fun talking to Al Bean. KSC Director Bob Cabana is coming up next. This is Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. I'm Jim Banky, and you're listening to WMMB. You're listening to a special Best of Space Talk, as your host takes a rare weekend to get away, relax, and enjoy the Independence Day festivities at, shall we say, an undisclosed location. Well, as you can tell, we've had some great guests this past year, and in fact, listening to some of them today. And I am proud to say that right from the beginning, we've enjoyed support for this program from some of the most senior leaders representing our space community, beginning with Frank DiBello from Space Florida on our very first show. And then on the second edition of Space Talk on June 27, 2009, Kennedy Space Center Director Bob Cabana joined us. We pick up the conversation talking about an upcoming launch that had been delayed because of a technical problem, which allowed us to showcase the incredible talent of the KSC workforce. And then we continue with some thoughts about the space shuttle's future, recorded, by the way, before we knew what President Obama was going to propose. And finally, with Bob Cabana being a fellow Minnesotan, we ended up the conversation with some great talk about football.
You mentioned it earlier. You know, whenever it comes to finding a solution to the problem, my money's on the KSC technicians. This is the finest group of folks anywhere. They know this vehicle inside and out, and if they can figure out a way to get this fixed in the most expeditious way and do it right, they're going to do it. So I'm confident we're going to figure it out, and we'll get Atlantis going on time.
Well, we talk about KSC crew as being miracle workers, like a certain engineer from a certain TV show. We've seen that demonstrated time and again. I'll just continue to talk about that because I remember a time when I think there was an engine. This is, goes back, obviously, quite a few years, but I remember there was a time when I think there was an engine issue. Maybe there was an abort on the pad, and they're going to have to swap out an engine, and oh my gosh, the shuttle was standing up in the vertical, and it just can't be done. They're going to have to roll back and take it off and delay this thing several months. And the guys got together and said, are you crazy? Here's how we'll do it. And they swapped it out at the pad, and it became standard operating procedure after that. These guys know their stuff, don't they?
They really do. I was over in the OPF a couple of weeks ago where they're working on Discovery, and you know, it is going to be a hard time here at the Kennedy Space Center a couple of years from now when we finally fly that that last shuttle mission. And unfortunately, a lot of really talented folks are going to be out of work, and we're doing our best to help alleviate that problem, mitigate it as best we can through a number of initiatives. But, you know, they are not distracted about the future. They are focused on the job at hand, and that is the safe processing of our vehicles. I've never seen a more focused, dedicated workforce, and I have absolutely no concern about them doing the job right. The last mission, when we fly it, is going to be as safer than any other mission that we've flown.
I got to agree with that. I mean, certainly I count among my friends some folks that work out there, and they're not going to do anything that's going to be quick and get in the way of having any issues come up. I remember the same stories being told about the guys that worked Apollo 17 back in 1972. It was their last launch, their last night, and literally the next morning had to turn in their badges. And I know that the crew will be good to the very end. And I know that the United Space Alliance and other contractors are doing a lot that they can to keep the crews motivated, to keep them interested, and to retain them to the end as well, as I understand. Because obviously, if you're worried about your career and your family, you might want to jump early and take another opportunity. But I know that some of these guys are taking a risk, if you will, and putting it out there to make sure this program ends on a high note. And I think that's very admirable.
Well, if you go over and talk to them, they treat that vehicle like it is a member of the family, and the crew that works on it is a family. It's not a vocation to these folks. It's an avocation. They just they're totally dedicated to it. And, you know, right at the end of that last flight, you know, there's not going to be a huge exodus. We still have to have the workforce available to safe all the vehicles and prepare mm-hmm. them for storage or shipment to museums. So there will be a general drawdown after that last mission.
And I know you're working, as I am in my own way, to make sure we keep one of those orbiters here. Now, as the director, are you going to sign something, a piece of paper for us, and resolve that issue once and for all?
Well, you know, I joked the other day. I figure having possession of it is, you know, that's pretty good. It's kind of hard to take it away from us.
Come and get it from us if you want it, right? I can see the 100
people.
You know,
we'll see. And I have to bow to the wishes of NASA headquarters, of course, but yeah. I think it would really be appropriate for one of the orbiters to stay here at the Kennedy Space Center along with our Saturn V rocket. This is where it first flew, where it last flew, and you know, I tell my folks, all the other centers are very important, and they all do great things. But none of them could do any of the great things they do if we didn't do our job well here. This is where the processing happens. This is where we launch humans and payloads to space and recover them safely. And nothing else happens unless we do it right here. So that's pretty neat. We ought to have an orbiter here to remember that by.
I absolutely agree.
One of the things that I tell all the folks here at KSC is that, yes, this is a very challenging time, and it's difficult as we transition the shuttle and move it into retirement and move on to a new vehicle. But the bottom line is I think we have a very bright future here at KSC because this is where NASA and the United States process payloads and launch humans and payloads to space and recover them. And we are going to have a NASA. We are going to have a space program. So whether it's the shuttle or some other vehicle, even if it's not the Ares 1 and Ares 5, whatever we're directed to do, we will have a space program where we operate out of here, out of KSC, launching out of away from Earth. So I think that's good, and I know this team, they just want to be Tell us what you want done. Give us the resources to do it, and we'll get it done.
So the big question, Bob, I know that you're a Minnesota Viking fan. Your time in Houston did not spoil you. You didn't become a Dallas Cowboy fan. The Texans is maybe a little flash in the pan before you got out. Tell me what you think about Brett Favre possibly playing for the Vikings this fall.
Well, I tell you, he is a phenomenal quarterback. And what I like about him is he never gives up, and the enthusiasm that he brings to the game. And I think that's everybody needs to have that enthusiasm for what they do. I know we got it here at KSC. And so I'm kind of hoping things work out and he gets to play a season with the Vikings, because I think he'd be fun to watch.
It'd
and
be fun.
It'd be fun to see him get even with those Green Bay Packers.
Purple jerseys with number 4 on for everybody. So we'll have our satellite tune in for that this fall and hope that that happens.
Well, it was great to have Bob Cabana on the show, and we look forward to having him on again real soon. Speaking of what's coming up here, a quick reminder as we close down the show for today, that NASA did formally retarget the last 2 shuttle missions. Discovery now set to fly on November 1st, about 4 o'clock, 4:30 or so in the afternoon. And then Endeavour will finish the shuttle program February 26th of 2011. No word yet on whether Atlantis will fly again following that, but the last 2 missions now on the books, officially rescheduled for November 1st and February 26th. So be sure and mark your calendars. Well, that's it for today. Next week, we return with a live program when our guest will be George Whitesides of Virgin Galactic. Thanks again for listening. Space Talk is sponsored by United Space Alliance and is a production of Mylos Solutions. Aaron Michaels is my personal chief engineer. I'm Jim Banky, and we'll talk to you again real soon. Now, the Home Mortgage Law Show is next, followed by Dan Connery, live and local at 4 p.m. right here on WMMB.